Great. Thanks very much. So I'm going to take you to Namibia now. And this project is one that we conducted between 2010 and 2012. And as you can see from the branding of the slides, it was funded by USAID, although I work for the International Center for Research on Women. And I'm presenting on behalf of my colleagues, also from ICRW, as well as from the implementing agency in Namibia, which was the Society for Family Health, and also from Bloomberg School of Public Health of Johns Hopkins, Hannah Lantos, who's also in the audience, is going to help dig me out of any misstatements I make about the data analysis. So I have no relationships to disclose. So just a little bit about the context of alcohol and HIV, and I'm not going to go into a lot of detail at this point because I have a feeling that this audience is already convinced that there is a strong link between HIV sexual risk behavior and alcohol use. And it's been very gratifying over the past decade to see how the research literature internationally has grown on this topic. More and more HIV researchers are adding alcohol use questions to their behavioral surveys, and it's been incredibly valuable. Interest has also been spiked since the movement towards treatment as prevention has gained steam. There's much more emphasis now on looking at alcohol use as a barrier to uptake and retention in ARV treatment. So I think that's also helped spur some research and get some more data for us to work with. What we don't have nearly enough of at this point is research data evidence on what works to prevent sexual risk behavior related to alcohol use. We've just had a few intervention studies done in sub-Saharan Africa, and none of them are showing a great deal of effect at this point. Although where we do have evidence, it really still lies in the area of using very individual-focused interventions, such as brief motivational interviewing and counseling with people who are coming in, for example, for HIV testing or for STD screening and treatment. So that's the area where the most progress has been made. But to tell the truth, we're still really very much at sea around issues around community-based interventions. And as you'll see in my presentation, the needs are tremendous, and it's a bit overwhelming to figure out what to do in many cases. But Namibia is a wonderful place to do this type of research. It's located in southern Africa. It has both a very severe HIV epidemic in 2010, 13.5% HIV prevalence. It's also a heavy drinking country, as is a lot of southern Africa. And Namibia is just, it's a bit, for, I think sub-Saharan Africa, the average drinking is about 6 liters per capita per year, and it's around 9.5 for Namibia. Namibia also has a type of drinking pattern where it is very much more related to binge drinking. So about half of Namibians don't drink at all. So all of that alcohol consumption is being done by half of the population who exhibits very, very heavy drinking behaviors, and a lot of that is binge drinking. So the project rationale was really to, address this limited evidence around how we can use community and environmental level strategies to reduce alcohol-related risks. And we were particularly interested in very small informal bars, known in southern Africa as shebeens. And these are really home-based bars. They're unlicensed, and much of the alcohol that they sell is actually brewed at home. And as I said, there are many of these bars in Namibia, and for many reasons, Namibia is a great site for this. In addition, Namibia's Ministry of Health has been on a campaign for about the past 10 to 15 years to really incorporate hazardous alcohol use as a component of their overall health strategy for the country. So that also made it kind of environmentally a nice place to do this type of research, because we had the promise that if we found something that seemed to be useful, that the Ministry of Health might be interested in taking it up. The media is also interested in this topic, and from time to time you'll get these periods of time where there's just a lot of media will really pick up the story and will run with it. This story actually came out In response to data that we released from our formative research that we had done for this project that I'm presenting. And the media found out about it, they interviewed a few people, they showed up in our study community, which is not very helpful, with their cameras rolling and tried to interview people. This headline is not one that I would choose, of course, but it is one that kind of reflects the moralistic attitude as well that a lot of Namibians take towards the issue of drinking. Remember, half of the country doesn't drink at all. So there's a very sort of either you do or you don't, and if you do, you're considered potentially a drunkard. So the policy environment and the evidence that we push into the policy environment, sometimes ends up with this type of result. Just some pictures of the intervention site. It's a peri-urban area just outside of Windhoek, and it's mostly inhabited by recent migrants from the northern part of the country who are coming to the city to establish a better life for themselves and their families. And they end up in settlements like this, which I wouldn't call them squatter settlements, but people do not own the land that they're living on. They just put up a shack. And try to start making a living. The first thing that people try when they start to make a living is usually selling alcohol, because that's the most accessible type of business that they can do. It doesn't take much capital to start up, and you can start up with just a very small amount of alcohol and at least bring in a little bit of cash every day. So for those reasons, alcohol selling has really become like the cornerstone of the informal economy in this community, and this is absolutely typical of urban, low-income communities across southern Africa. So these are just some of the issues that confront people in this community. Problems with infrastructure, a lot of crime, of course, very high unemployment, probably 90% unemployment, and alcohol selling is one of the few things people can do. There's also a real absence of civil society organizations. There's really very little social capital in this community. People don't feel that there's necessarily a way to make their voices heard or their concerns known, or even if they did, that anything would happen about it. So this is just outside of a shebeen. This is a typical of what the types of bars that we were working in were. They're literally just, from people's homes. We did a census of all the bars in that community. It's about four square kilometers, and we counted about 250 bars. So it's literally about every 30 meters there's someone selling alcohol. So the community is literally awash in alcohol. You wonder how people even make money selling it, right? But they do. People in the community are concerned about alcohol, not because of HIV, mostly because of the other types of negative effects that they see it having on their communities. From our formative research, our baseline survey, about 11% of monthly income was spent on alcohol. People were concerned about kids not being able to go to school. There's a lot of concern about violence and alcohol. People feel that felt that bars at baseline were very unsafe. There's no police. There's very little enforcement. There is an alcohol policy in Namibia, and you are required to have a license, but it's very difficult to get one, and most people don't. And there's no enforcement in any case. These are just some local advertisements that appear around this community and around Windhoek. Generally, relating as they do in our society as well, alcohol use to masculinity, a lot of aspirational ideas about alcohol drinking, especially adverts. I don't have a picture of one, but adverts, showing, women dressed in business suits drinking alcohol. The industry is really going after women very strongly as well. That's showing these aspirational images of how alcohol use is associated with wealth and success. There's a lot of sex exchanged for alcohol at bars. We saw that in our baseline survey. And the bar owners really didn't feel empowered to do much about it. And that's one of the primary areas that we wanted to intervene on. You can see this quote at the bottom where bar owners won't want to reduce the amount of alcohol their patrons consume because it will affect their profits, and they get more money when people are drinking too much. And this was an in-depth interview with a male bar patron. So we went about testing this assumption to see if we could actually work with informal bar owners, and were the constraints of poverty so much that we couldn't partner with them to find some community level support for making their alcohol selling a bit safer. This is all goes by way of a harm reduction approach, definitely. And in the absence of any type of enforcement or regulation at the national level, that is implemented at the community level, this is sort of what we're left with. So our intervention had two components, and we intervened over the course of 1 year. One was community mobilization, and we put together a community action committee to lead and oversee the mobilization activities, and they selected and trained volunteers, and they did house-to-house awareness raising and also group discussions at markets and such. And then in the bars, our interest is really in creating risk-averse bar environments. So we recruited and trained bar owners and mentored them through a process of figuring out how to make their bars safer and how they could intervene to both sell alcohol more safely as well as to talk to their patrons about the risk of HIV infection and just do some basic HIV prevention work as they actually sold alcohol. I just want to say a little bit more about the bar-based activities. So it was about these interpersonal interventions as well as changing structural aspects of the bar. So it's both these discussions and informational types of things and these one-to-one interactions, but also enforcing more regular hours. And in fact, we encouraged folks to reduce the number of hours that they were open, which we thought was going to be a no-go, but actually turned out to be reasonably doable. Selling food options, selling non-alcoholic beverages, making sure condoms were available, although that was already happening before we started. We just we enhanced that, and then displaying posters and other communication materials. So our evaluation objectives is very much a pilot project. We really just wanted to find out could we do it, and if we could do it, we wanted to measure the exposure. So how well did patrons actually report that they saw or engaged in any of these activities? And then we wanted to do a little bit of pre-post measurement of preliminary program effect, and then document lessons that we were learning along the way. So the outcome measures that we looked at quantitatively included alcohol use using audit. We were interested particularly in binge drinking, sexual risk intentions, which is things around discussing condoms, some alcohol expectancy questions, sexual behaviors, knowledge, and people's perception of how safe they felt at the bar and how frequently sex was being transacted and there was violence. So in terms of the data collection, we conducted a quantitative survey pre-post. We used time, location, sampling to recruit representatives. And I'm happy to talk more about time, location, sampling in the question session if you'd like more information about that. But we also did qualitative data collection and monitoring data. We actually had very little time to implement the intervention. It was literally 12 months from start to finish. And the first 3 months was, of course, just getting things ramped up. So I would say probably we had a good 6 months of pretty high functioning implementation of the program. In terms of sampling bars, so for the baseline, we randomly sampled from that 256 number that we had counted at the beginning. We sampled 43 of them in order to get a sample of 500 patrons. And then at N-line, we sampled the 24 bars, but only those that had participated in the project. And only three of those bars are represented at both the baseline and the N-line sample. So it's obviously not a great comparison, but we did look at some dose response effects to kind of tease out how well to better attribute some of the effects that we saw to participation in the intervention. Mostly young, unmarried people, a lot of primary education, but very little secondary education. About a third of men and 40% of women had salaried employment. So just in terms of the exposure, I mean, the first thing you always worry about after you've done an intervention is, was anyone exposed to it? And that's not a small question. I mean, I'm sure I'm not alone in having interventions where you figure out, you know, towards the end that you maybe haven't exposed people enough. But we looked at this, and in general, we found that there was a considerable amount of exposure in terms of changing the environment, bar owners intervening with customers. Six of the 24 bars in the end were considered highly adherent to the intervention. And the exposure to community mobilization was also relatively high. So this is just showing you the numbers of percentages of people who directly experienced two or more interventions. So you can see that about 35% of men and 24% of women experienced two or more interventions. And then almost half of men actually observed others in the bars experiencing the interventions. So that was a fairly decent exposure rate given the short duration of the intervention. Observed changes to bars. There was a substantial number of people reported increased alcohol, seeing alcohol-related materials, condom availability a little bit more, but as I said, that was already happening. 33%, this is interesting, noted decreased bar hours, which we thought was going to be one of the hardest things to enact, but it turned out that bar owners were actually interested in reducing the hours of their bars. They did not like to be open late at night. They were having a lot of problems with violence, and just the longer they're open, the more people get drunk and the more havoc ensues. So, in fact, that turned out to be counterintuitively one of the easier things to do. Just a modest increase in the sale of non-food items. I think a lot of bar owners didn't have the capital to necessarily institute that change. Whereas changing your bar hours reduces your profit, perhaps, but perhaps the risk-benefit ratio to bar owners was in the favor of changing their bar hours. And community mobilization was likewise, about a third of people had actually participated in a home visit or community meeting, and many more people had heard about others doing so. Oh, I should just say that, volunteers conducted 77 events, and they reached over 750 community members through the community mobilization. The pre-post analysis, just quickly, we had some changes. Nothing around sexual risk behavior changed. Alcohol consumption still remained quite prevalent, but some other issues, as well as some other issues, violence, for example, were found both before and after. But we did find some possible improvements over time. We saw a reduction in audit scores, frequency of binge drinking, and also people really started to, there was a notable increase in the number of people who perceived safety within their bars. Rates of transactional sex, violence, and intoxication as well. Now, the power of inference from our pre-post is obviously very restricted, we realize that. So I think that, you know, these have to be taken with a little bit of skepticism. But we did see audit scores go down. Binge drinking decreased a lot, 54% to 25%. Sexual behavior, as I said, nothing. HIV knowledge was already high at the beginning. So we did a dose response analysis to see if higher program exposure was associated with more positive outcomes at NLINE. And we did, in fact, see some ways in which that was true. So we divided bars by being adherent or less adherent. Adherent bars, and you can help me out with this, Hannah, I think were where 30% of the individuals had been exposed to three or more activities. And 40% had seen someone experience those activities. And we looked at it by the bar level and the individual level. So the key takeaways were just that the bar staff seemed to be appropriately targeting intervention to high-risk patrons. So the patrons who reported the most, having experienced most individual level interventions, were also the heavier drinking patrons. There were improved sexual risk intentions around condom use. There were no more risk-averse sexual practices. That had not changed. And we saw the biggest reduction in binge drinking actually happened with women, not with men. And the program was definitely linked to better perceived safety within bars. And this is just a little bit of a glimpse at the dose response by sexual risk individual level exposure. So you can see that for the first four variables around condom use, there were very many more people who reported these who were exposed to the intervention. And it's particularly interesting on the third one obtained a condom at the bar where they were recruited. This was very encouraging to us because this really kind of indicated to us that something was different was happening within these bars. It was encouraging men to actually pick up those condoms. Whether or not they were used is another matter. So study limitations, obviously low power of attribution. Again, this is the pilot study. We were not out to conduct an efficacy study. There's some selection bias related to which bar owners may have, you know, wanted to participate in the program. And short time frame to observe results. Social desirability, external. One thing to mention about the external environment was towards the end of the intervention period, the city of Windhoek decided to go on a huge crackdown campaign, and it swept through these communities, shutting down informal bars. That didn't actually happen in our study community, but it was happening all around. We're not sure what effect that had on our measurements, but it was certainly a difficulty that occurred. And I think overall, I would say a big lesson learned was that these informal bar owners, while living on the extreme poverty line, they were willing partners in this. We felt that multi-level interventions, are feasible. They seem to resonate with the community. HIV isn't, a top priority for people in terms of alcohol use, but when you introduce it into a program in which alcohol is addressed as a public health threat, and you talk about HIV within amongst many other threats like violence or harm to children, for example, that you can get some traction there. On metrics and our measurement, I think there's certain challenges related to working in a community where there's a lot of population turnover, where there are people, there are migrants that come in, they move out. You could maybe enroll a cohort of people to follow and only retain a small percentage of them, as well as the bar owners. Bars open and close constantly. So how would you conduct an efficacy trial, for example? In a community like this where you really needed that type of longitudinal data. It's not clear to me. Just some acknowledgments. PEPFAR was incredibly supportive, and all of our various partners are listed here. Thank you.
Thank you.